welcome to Generation Squeeze's Hard Truths podcast. My name is Omer. I am the Knowledge to Action Lead with Gen Squeeze. I'm joined by my colleague, Megan Wild, our Strategic Communications Lead. Megan and I are going to be chatting today with freelance labor journalist, Emma Arkell. Emma recently did a report for Chatelaine about the staffing crisis that childcare centers across the country are experiencing. And she highlighted the fact that this could have significant implications for the planned rollout of $10 a day childcare. Megan, would you like to start us off?
Well, I wanted first off to just give Emma a chance to tell us a little about her story. It was a really great feature about profiling one childcare center in particular, but really got a deep dive into some of the problems that are threatening the success of the $10 a day childcare.
Yeah, so the story looks at Alamathau, which is a childcare center in Chilliwack, BC on Stalo Nation land. And I started talking to them about a year and a half ago when I was working on a research project into the childcare workforce in BC as part of my master's degree. And I found that their story was a really like interesting microcosm for what's going on in childcare centers across BC and across the country, where they are trying to expand. There's, you know, even government money that they're receiving in order to expand, to offer more childcare spaces. But because of the low wages, poor working conditions, lack of benefits, and a feeling of a lack of respect for childcare workers, they really struggle to find staff. And so I wanted to use that as sort of a little way into this bigger issue.
And I guess tell us more about, it was such a poignant microcosm, like you said. Can you tell us what the more precise issues that center was facing?
Sure. Well, that center in particular received a grant to renovate their basement, which was being used for storage, and they got money to renovate it so that they can open, you know, 20 more childcare spaces. It would also allow them to open a space, like a sensory room, because they cater to a lot of children who require some additional support. And that, you know, should be a great thing. We have this new childcare system being built, and so being able to open new spaces should be an unequivocal good. But the manager told me that when she received that news, you know, and this is after years of applying for money to renovate the basement, that she just felt panicked and that she really didn't know how she was going to find the staff in order to staff the spaces that they would open. And this isn't the first time that that center has encountered that problem. In the past, they had tried to open infant toddler spaces, which are very sought after, I think, as any parent in this country knows. But because of a lack of staff with their infant toddler certificate, which is a voluntary certification you can get after you finish your ECE degree, they just couldn't keep those spaces open for a long period of time. It was really difficult for them. And so, yeah, I thought that that was an interesting way into the issue.
The federal government announced $10 a day childcare in, what was it, April, May of 2021. That was when the announcement was first made. Mm-hmm. And since then, there's been slow and steady progress with deals being made between the federal government and the provinces. And I think at this point, all the provinces and territories have finally, I think Ontario was the last one. Is that right?
I believe so, yeah.
The Ontario government dragged its feet, but eventually signed a deal. And so, okay, problem solved, right?
Not quite. It's going to take a number of years to build a new social service, right? Like, I was listening to an interview that Generation Squeeze did with Linnell Anderson, and she really frames it really well. Like, this is the first major social service or social program that we're building in decades. And so these things just don't happen overnight. And while some parents are definitely getting access to, you know, $10 a day or reduced fee childcare, and that's, you know, sometimes life-changing for them given how expensive childcare can be, this is going to take a number of years, I would say decades. I think it's good that we're looking 10 years in the future. I think we also need to think 20 and 30 years in the future. This needs to be, you know, a staple of Canadian society in the same way that we think of like Medicare and socialized healthcare as being a staple of Canadian society.
You write in the piece, across the country, low wages and poor working conditions have pushed many early childhood educators out of the field, resulting in a decades-long worker retention crisis. Just as federal and provincial governments are making historic investments to build a universal childcare system, childcare centers are struggling to find staff, putting promises of $10 a day childcare at risk. And this is something you really underline in your story, that, you know, this problem of staff retention is decades old. And I think you cite a study or a survey from 1984.
Oh, yeah, that was the one we often cite about how people who care for animals at zoos earn more than daycare workers. I think that's gotten better. I was curious, so I looked up the current median wages for daycare workers, and now I think they make a few dollars more than zoo attendants. But that fact that since the 1980s, that's the progress we made, does probably even more than that original statistic.
Yeah, it's a bit strange to me that you have all of this money for expanding spaces, but you aren't seeing the same attention given to the problem of staff retention. Why is that?
I mean, I think governments like to open things. I think we love to cut ribbons. You know, there's that part of it, I think. And you're trying to correct for something that is decades in the making. You know, these workers have been making low wages since the 80s and before that, because this is feminized labor. And we devalue labor that we associate with women, that we associate with caring. Whether we are doing this consciously or not, we think that the intrinsic benefits that you may get from that kind of work, you know, a good feeling of being connected to other people, that these in some way make up for low wages. And you see that in many caring professions. And so we're trying to correct for a systemic and like deeply rooted injustice, which is that people in caring positions, most often women and femme people, make very low wages and their work is not respected in the way that other work is. And it's easier to open some, you know, a new building than it is to slowly and methodically make more spaces in programs where people can get those certifications to work in those industries, than it is to get employers, whether with the carrot or the stick, to pay their workers more and to offer benefits and pensions and the things that keep people in their jobs and the things that make workers' lives worth living and allow people to live with dignity. These are not easy things to fix. I think that there are ways to fix them, but it takes a lot of time.
So just to concretize what you're saying here, you point out that the annual employment income for early childhood educators and assistants across the country is $26,800. Just want to briefly pause and say that again, $26,800, nearly 30% less than the average Canadian worker. That is not a lot of money.
No.
For work that is actually quite difficult.
Yeah, that statistic and that report that Statistics Canada did was kind of the impetus for me to pursue this project, because I had been, you know, I was at Press Progress, I was doing a labor reporting internship, and I was focusing on the way in which the early pandemic was impacting women's work. And people had been telling me to, you know, write about childcare, but this is in spring of 2021, when those agreements were being made with the federal government and this announcement that there was, you know, billions of dollars to create this new system. And honestly, at the time, I thought, why would I pursue that? It seemed like it was being covered quite a bit. And it wasn't until I started reading about the wages and the working conditions that I realized there was this part of the story that wasn't really being told. And I think that that is improving now. The coverage that I see of the childcare sector now does more often take workers into account. But in those early months and years, I wasn't seeing that. I was seeing a lot of discussion of parent fees, and that's very important. But you can't talk about parent fees and availability of spaces without also talking about the people who staff those spaces.
Yeah, I'm going to throw in my as a parent piece here, because it really hit home my experience in my 2 years in Canada. When we arrived, we had a frantic scramble to get into daycare because we didn't realize how hard it was going to be. We kept getting told that wait lists were like 5 or 6 years. This is for 3 to 5 year old programs. And we ended up having to pay $2,000 a month for a few months because it was the only space we could find, and it was a home daycare. And contrast that with now, where our 4-year-old's in a university daycare. Because of the move towards universal childcare, we now pay $400 a month. And I can't say enough how life-changing that is, especially given how much more of our income goes to groceries suddenly. Like, that is huge. Like, you want to just celebrate that. But then I think what your story to me highlights is the change that's been made is tremendous and precious. And like, this just highlights how urgently we need to strengthen it and protect it so that it succeeds. There was one quote in particular that stood out for me. The only way to have the childcare that all the parents want and that we've been working for 50 years is to have it be publicly funded with really solid public policy. And then you went on to talk about how there's three pillars of a successful universal childcare program. Affordable fees, which is where we have made huge progress and we should celebrate that. But then there's the available spaces and good working conditions. So I think it was such a call to action to work harder on those latter two pillars.
Yeah, and the cost of childcare, that's really what a lot of parents care about. And actually, the cost of childcare, a lot of that is due to labor costs. And so trying to keep costs low means that, you know, there's going to be a downward pressure on the wages that early childhood educators are paid. So there's this conflict between the interests of parents and the interests of the workers. But as you point out, if we don't pay childcare workers enough, they're just not going to be in the field very long. And as a result, there's not going to be enough spaces for parents to put their kids in.
Yeah, absolutely. And if childcare workers are burning out, they're not going to be able to provide the quality care that they want to provide and that they are capable of providing. So ensuring that they are well compensated, that they have access to benefits so that they can take days off when they are sick or burnt out or when they have emergencies of their own, and even, you know, having pensions so that they're taken care of later in life. These things are going to keep people in the field and they're going to allow them to provide quality care. And all of the childcare operators and workers that I've spoken to, you know, are aware of the tension between raising wages and how that could cause parent fees to go up. Like, they're very aware of that tension. And some, you know, who have been in the field for a really long time say that they kept, you know, like, they themselves were not able to provide their children with good quality childcare. You know, they were essentially living in poverty because they wanted to keep the parent fees low. Like, they feel as though they have sacrificed over the past few decades in order to keep those fees low. You know, that tension wouldn't exist if we had public funding. And I also want to say that tension is made worse when for-profit operators enter the sphere, because when you have a not-for-profit or public facility, you know, 80% of their costs maybe go to labor, go to paying the wages of their workers, but there's no need to also make a profit. When you insert the need to make a profit into that equation, something's got to give, right? And it's probably going to be the labor costs, the human resources, as it were. So I think that this really speaks to the need to have a robust, publicly funded system.
It's interesting the parallels between the other publicly funded system of medical care and just how, you know, the answer in that system to a shortage of workers, of family practice doctors, was this huge pay raise. And I think that, again, points to the culture change that's needed, because nobody bats an eye about paying doctors $150,000 more. But when it comes to how do we solve this shortage of workers, it's a lot harder to rally interest and support and paying them what is a livable wage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it speaks to the class dynamics at play. We really don't bat an eye at paying doctors very well, and they do very important work and they should be well compensated. But when it comes to care aides in long-term care homes, even, we've seen a downward pressure over the past couple decades on their wages because they are more often women. They are more often immigrant and racialized women, and their work does not command the respect necessarily that other medical professionals do.
Can you talk about the certification that childcare workers need? I mean, I know it's different in different provinces, but that's one of the parts of your story that I think is also very interesting, that those requirements can also get in the way of, you know, making sure that there are enough staff.
Yeah, the certification process varies from province to province. I can really only speak to the situation here in BC because that's where I live and where I've been doing this work. There's different levels. There's, you know, responsible adult, which is something that you can do, I think, in a weekend. There's early childhood educator assistance, which requires a little bit more education. There's the, sort of the standard ECE, early childhood educator certification. And then beyond that, you know, you could do a four-year degree, you could get a master's, but those aren't required to work in the sector. What's generally seen as the requirement is the ECE certification. And then you can, beyond that, get your special needs certification or your infant toddler. And I think some of the barriers that exist to people accessing that education, and I will get into this in a future piece, the tuition obviously is a barrier. We've seen post-secondary education become more and more expensive over the past couple decades. That's certainly true in early childhood education, just as it is in, you know, pretty much any other degree or certification. Beyond that, these programs also often require an unpaid practicum. And so that's 4 to 6 weeks of unpaid work. And that's a lot to ask, I think, of anyone. I think that there's, you know, more and more of a shift to not expecting people to do unpaid internships. We recognize that that is a barrier for low-income people and that it's a lot to ask of someone to do weeks or months of unpaid labor, but it's still very much the norm in early childhood education. And I know there have been some efforts to change that. I've spoken to people who have spoken to government officials about changing this, but I continue to speak to workers, you know, who are recently certified and they were expected to do weeks of unpaid practicum. And it's just a lot to ask of people, especially when you're working in a field in which the wages are so low, making the investment into tuition and then the investment into weeks of unpaid labor is all the more difficult when you're going to go into a field where you could be earning $20 an hour for years, maybe indefinitely. You know, it's tough to crack $30 an hour in this sector. And so how do people pay back, you know, the loans that they may take out in order to pay for that? It's very difficult for people.
So you've sort of hinted at or talked a little bit about the lack of respect that childcare workers feel. That didn't really come out as much in your piece. Or maybe that was just me reading it. I don't know. But yeah, I wonder if you could talk about that. I mean, is it just as a result of low wages, bad working conditions, or is there something else that's going on? Is there like interactions with parents or, you know, what are people feeling?
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting aspect of the sector that I'm not sure has made it into my pieces that I've published so far. Because a like lack of respect is such sort of like an amorphous thing to try and capture. when I speak to childcare workers and advocates and people in the sector, almost everyone has brought up a lack of respect for the work that they do. And I think that some of that does come from parents. You know, I remember one worker told me that around Christmas time, they were meeting with a parent, you know, like after a program, and they were given a Christmas gift. And the worker saw that, you know, they had other things, other gifts with them. And the parent said, oh, those are for their teacher. It's for their child's teacher.
The teacher.
And so, yeah, making this distinction between a childcare worker, an early childhood educator, as it were, and someone who works in the public education system who is a teacher, I think can be frustrating for people who spend so much of their day with children, who put so much energy and effort into educating young children, to then be reminded, like, but you're not a teacher. So I think some of it is coming from parents, and I don't think parents always realize that they're doing it. The low wages, lack of benefits, and poor working conditions definitely reflect, I think, to childcare workers, a lack of respect for their work. And then I think there's something interesting going on where when you look at like the surveys that have been done of the childcare workforce that are trying to capture what's going on with childcare in BC right now, one of the things that the survey does is it does like a general population survey to see how people feel about childcare and childcare workers. And in that survey, it actually shows a very high level of respect from the public for childcare workers. So I think there's sort of an interesting disconnect, because I think the pandemic and the creation of a universal childcare system has shifted the way that people think of childcare and the way that people see childcare workers. I think there is a decent amount of respect, but that respect is not necessarily being felt by the people doing the work. And I'm not really sure. I don't know, but there's just like an interesting disconnect there.
Megan, did you want to come in?
Oh, no, I mean, it was interesting because I just thought of it, that very thing yesterday, because I think in particular of after school care programs, and I feel like they especially don't get the respect and care from parents that they deserve. And being Valentine's Day, it was interesting. And I picked up one kid from her classroom, and her teacher's desk was full of Valentine's treats. At my other daughter's daycare, you know, I saw some parents bring in like flowers, but it was like flowers for a staff of like six people that were going to be in and out that day. and then at the after school care, like there was nothing. The guy acted really surprised when I gave him candy. So like, I think it is weird how parents have these hierarchies of like, all of these people are critical to the care of our children. It's there. I don't know how you change that.
Yeah. And just to be, I guess, forthcoming, my question about this, Emma, was a bit leading, I guess, because I've seen other parents and the attitudes they have towards, you know, the people who look after their kids. And oftentimes it's very disrespectful. And it stands in contrast to how much parents complain when they talk about how difficult it is to look after young children. You know, when they talk about it, about that experience for themselves, like, oh, it's, you know, it's terrible, sleepless nights, and you don't have a moment to sit down. And then you talk about dropping them off at daycare, and, you know, it's a completely different story. Then the childcare workers should be happy to be spending time with their kids for low wages.
Yeah, or they should be happy to do something that they clearly love so much. Like it's this thing that we love to use against people who get to pursue their passion for a living. You know, that you should just be happy to be able to do that. And, you know, the benefits that you get from that, the fulfillment should make up for the low wages, lack of support, lack of benefits that you may suffer through. And we just don't do that to other people who I think are also pursuing their passions. You know, I think engineers are also pursuing a passion. I'm sure lots of them love their jobs, but we never use that passion to justify their low wages. Not to say that everyone in engineering is, you know, making a ton of money. I just immediately thought of like the Twitter engineers when I said that. And I was like, no, I actually feel really bad for those guys right now. I don't think they're having a very good time.
I'm sure they're doing fine. I mean, I don't know. It's fine. Anyway, we don't have to get into that. Do you see any signs of things improving in the sector for workers?
I think there are some signs of improvement. You know, here in BC, the provincial government has made investments in the wage enhancement, which adds now $4 on top of hourly wages for certified early childhood educators. That is an improvement. And when we look at like the surveys that have been done of the workforce, there are lots of people speaking to the fact that like now they don't have to worry about paying bills at the end of the month. You know, now they can like have family over for celebratory dinners, and that's not a challenge for them to afford that. And so that is significant, and that is making a difference in people's lives. At the same time, I was, you know, just looking over my notes from the most recent survey of the childcare workforce, which was done in the year 2021, and a lot of the indicators of burnout are higher than they've ever been. The number of childcare facilities that are having trouble finding staff are higher than they've ever been. A lot of the indicators that there is still a massive issue with retention and recruitment in the sector, they're still there. And so as much as we're like making small amounts of progress, I think we're starting to see the holes in those programs, you know, that some of these programs are leaving out workers who maybe should be included in them. In that, I'm thinking of the wage enhancement. There's a lot of discussion around the eligibility requirements for that, and I write about that in a upcoming piece. And also the importance of benefits. You know, we talk a lot about wages, and wages are very important, but having a solid jobs benefits package, having a pension, these are also going to keep people from leaving the sector. So yeah, it's really tough to say if it's getting better or worse. That latest survey definitely does make me a little worried. I also think that like we're not really taking into account the impact of COVID on this workforce. This is a frontline workforce that has been working with children in the same way that people in the public education sector have been working with children. Means that they've likely been exposed to COVID multiple times, had multiple infections. That is going to have an impact on this workforce. We know that a certain number of people who contract COVID get long COVID, and a lot of those people are not going to be able to work. And I don't really see that discussion being had, but it's something that does concern me. And it's tough to organize in this sector because it's a sector in which there are a lot of small employers. So, you know, it's a lot easier to organize when you work at an Amazon facility with 500 or 1,000 other people. Not to say that organizing at Amazon is easy by any means, because they invest billions in union busting. But I have spoken to people in organized labor who represent childcare workers. Some of the workers in this sector are organized. It's very low. I think it's around like 10% of the workforce in BC, the childcare workforce in BC, is unionized. And they're hesitant to say this, but it's a fact that the amount of resources that you need to invest in order to organize a workplace, that needs to come back in the form of dues, right? And so if you're organizing a workforce of 15 people, it can be difficult to justify the amount of time and energy that you're going to have to expend into organizing that small workforce when you know you're not going to get that much money back in dues. I'm very interested to, yeah, I don't know. I've been reading a lot about sectoral bargaining, and I would love to explore more how that could be used in this sector in order to, you know, raise wages and working conditions, meaningfully, like in a big way, as opposed to hoping that all of these small facilities, these small childcare centers organize, because that could take a long, long time.
You've mentioned that you have, that you're going to continue to work on this issue. And so maybe people would be interested to follow your work. Where can they find you online and see what you've published?
Yeah, people can follow me on Twitter if it still exists when this is published and is still usable. My handle is EmmaArkell7 for some reason. Going to be continuing to write a lot about childcare. I'm increasingly writing about healthcare, which is probably a bad sign because you don't want a labor journalist paying too much attention to your sector. Yeah, also writing about the organizing that's going on in post-secondary, which I think is fascinating. Yeah, I'm a freelance journalist. I'm publishing in a lot of different places, but the best place to find me is probably on Twitter.
Okay. Well, thanks so much, Emma, for making the time. This has been great.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.